Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Matthew here. You might have noticed that Scaffold has been on hiatus, and it's because I've been putting together a new podcast, which was just released last week. It's called Power and Public Space, and it really is about exactly that, featuring short conversations with architects, artists, and academics that offer new possibilities for understanding and making public spaces today. It's 10 episodes, all of which are streaming now, and feature the likes of Liza Fior, a director of the feminist art and architecture practice called MUF, Manuel Hirsch, the architect who designed the Babyn Yar Synagogue in Kiev, and even the admin behind the anonymous Instagram meme account, Dank Lloyd Wright. As a way of introducing the new podcast series, I thought I'd play an extended version of one of my favorite interviews from it, which was with the professor Mabel O. Wilson. In it, we focus on the memorial to enslaved laborers at the University of Virginia, which she helped design, but we also touch on Wilson's experience as a Black woman studying architecture in the 80s and 90s, as well as her thoughts on the fraught significance of classicism in contemporary architecture, among other things. Anyways, I hope you enjoy it, and to find the whole series, just search for Power and Public Space wherever you're listening to this now. All right, so here it is, the extended version of my interview with Professor Mabel O. Wilson for the podcast series Power and Public Space. You're listening to Power and Public Space, a co-production of Drawing Matter and the Architecture Foundation. I'm your host, Matthew Blunderfield. In 2020, the Memorial to Enslaved Laborers opened at the University of Virginia. Designed as a collaboration between Haller and Yoon Architecture, Professor Mabel O. Wilson, landscape architects Greg Bleem and Frank Dukes, and the artist Eto Otutigbe. As Professor Wilson has explained, civic buildings and monuments in the U.S. often become sites to imagine and enact American whiteness. And in this episode, Wilson discusses how the memorial was conceived and designed to assert its position within the campus's Eurocentric architectural context, whilst addressing the university's history of racism and recovering lost narratives of enslaved people in the process. We recorded this conversation in February of 2022. Wilson was in New York, where she's a professor in the School of Architecture at Columbia, and I was at the Architecture Foundation in London. All right, so here's my conversation with Professor Mabel O. Wilson. Basically, I want to understand how one goes about designing a monument to Black life and Black history in the United States. But before we talk about the design of the memorial to enslaved laborers, I wondered if we could talk about the context that that memorial sits within first, and that's the campus of the University of Virginia. So you've mentioned elsewhere that civic buildings and monuments in the United States are often emblematic of a disavowal of the founding precepts of liberty, equality, and justice, where they become sites to imagine and enact American whiteness. And so you give examples like the plans for Washington, D.C., the Smithsonian Institute, the Virginia State Capitol, but the University of Virginia itself is no exception here. So I wondered if you could help me understand more about how whiteness is enacted through these kinds of buildings and monuments, and specifically through the design of the University of Virginia itself.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really great question, and I appreciate that you know you use the term whiteness, because I think that as a descriptor emergent from how human difference was racialized, you know, I mean, who can say when it began, but it really begins in the 15th century. And I think that racialization of human difference that creates hierarchies and creates certain kinds of valuations, which are economic, which capitalism takes advantage of, but also political, which says who or who can't be citizen, or, you know, literally within sciences, who can or cannot be human, even, you know, that it produces these sorts of registers that really construct modernity and not just, you know, these buildings that you cite, you know, in the Mid-Atlantic and in Virginia. And I think in my own work, it's been really important to start to understand that this isn't just architecture. It's a question of modernity, and the ways in which liberal democracy, liberal subjectivity, is constructed through Europe's project of colonization and eventually imperialism of Asia, Africa, and the New World. And so all of these differences are emergent, and architecture is completely, the Western arts of building is completely entangled with that project. And this specific context of the emergent institutions of American democracy, I think, are an excellent example to kind of show how, you know, that those differences that are racialized are emergent, so that you can have monuments to freedom, natural rights, equality, liberty, justice, all of these things that are enshrined in the Declaration of Independence as the first blow against the monarchy and the Constitution. But yet all of these sites are built by enslaved labor on land taken from indigenous peoples. And the University of Virginia is no different. It's the land of the Manahoke that were incrementally pushed off as English settlement moved westward into the Piedmont region. And that includes Thomas Jefferson's ancestors who claimed large tracts of land. And as they claimed tracts of land, often through indentured servants. You know, every time they brought over an indentured servant, they got 50 acres of land. Every time they bought a slave, they could get 50 acres of land. So it allowed Virginia's elite class, very powerful, wealthy class that included Jefferson and James Madison, George Washington, to have immense power because they had so much land. And so someone like Jefferson, you know, he's a landowner, right? And he has this land that he says, well, this is perfect for the construction of a new educational institution that will train future leaders of the nation in medicine and in law and in business and in statesmanship, right? And yet the whole thing is constructed by and run by enslaved labor, which is completely antithetical to those values.
You were a student at the University of Virginia, and you mentioned that your arrival as an architecture student there was one of being steeped into this Eurocentric vision, where you really never saw your own culture or history. I remember you mentioning in another interview that you likened it to this experience of being a kind of vampire, where there's just no reflection of you anywhere. Can you talk more about that experience and how that informed your attitude towards architecture and its possibilities?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very strange, almost a very disconcerting experience, especially at the level of the college. I mean, I think when you're kind of doing high school in the U.S., you know, it is what your education is what you get. I went to public schools, you know, I mean, this was the curriculum. I had no choice. But when you get to college, you choose majors. And so I chose architecture, and I would take history classes. History was being incorporated into studio. We were looking at, you know, Italian villas and palazzos, the Noli map. I took a course in British architectural history, you know, and not once in any of those classes was colonialism ever, other than colonial style architecture, but the legacies of colonialism in the transatlantic slave trade that was building the wealth of those people who were building those Palladian villas ever mentioned. Never once, you know, because here we are at UVA, there is the lawn, you know, and we had to go out and we had to sketch it. And, you know, here is Thomas Jefferson. I mean, not only is he a brilliant statesman, but, you know, he's America's first architect. And look at the proportions and look at, you know, the pedagogy of the different, you know, pavilions and each style and how they were supposed to be teaching the students. And here you are learning in that tradition. But never once was it mentioned that there were enslaved people who built that and worked the grounds. And, you know, just not that far from the university is Monticello, his home, which is literally on the back of the nickel, right? The 5-cent coin in the U.S., you know, and even then, you know, the enslaved were referred to as servants. And they were just then beginning to do the archaeological excavations of what was called Mulberry Row, which is where all the, you know, some of the enslaved dependencies were actually located. But it just wasn't mentioned. And so, you know, there's a history there, but you never see it. It's never mentioned in your formal education. And so I just became very confounded and disillusioned, actually, and frustrated. And so I ended up leaving for a semester and I ended up at the AA, which actually was a much more liberating intellectual and personal exploration that then gave me this other sense of what can be done in architecture. And I'm so thankful for that experience because it really changed the ways in which I felt I could have agency in my own education.
In a way, it seems like the design of this new memorial to enslaved laborers, which was opened, I think, in 2020, it feels like it is, in a way, performing the act of recovering agency in the context of a setting that exhibits, as you just discussed, all the hallmarks of this kind of dissonance of American democracy and the contradictions or hypocrisies of American democracy. I think maybe now is a good time to start talking about the way in which you and the team of architects and landscape architects, which included Heller and Yoon, Greg Bleem, Frank Dukes, and Eto Otetegbe, how you went about as a team reconceiving of the idea of a monument, given this really fraught tradition of monuments in the U.S.
I think it wasn't a traditional competition, but because of UVA is a public university, it was sort of a tender. You had to interview, essentially. And I think we got the project. Edo wasn't yet part of the team, because we were going to help the university ask the questions to figure out what it was that they needed, because they weren't quite sure. They knew they wanted to do a memorial. That came from student pressure over the years. They had already started an intensive project of understanding the history of slavery at the university. And there was a formal commission established by the president of the university to do that. So when we walked into that context in 2016, you know, there had at least been 5 years of work on the topic and building up a knowledge, working through the archives, and also reaching out beyond the university to the African-American community of Charlottesville, and also trying to figure out who might have been descended from this enslaved community. So we felt as a team that it was important to try to hear what it was that people wanted, what their aspirations were, what kind of work they thought the memorial could do. And I think as a team, we understood the project in the context of Black Lives Matter. Like, we even talked about it in our presentation, that this was the social context in which memorials, particularly in Virginia, we showed a slide, I remember, of Black Lives Matter written on a monument on Monument Avenue in Richmond, right, which was this kind of pantheon of Confederate leaders and soldiers. And so we were clear kind of about the problematic ways in which the past had been memorialized. Also in Charlottesville, you know, Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson had monuments in parks in the middle of the city. And Frank Dukes, who's a conflict mediator, had been involved with the city writing a blue ribbon document, a commission to write a document, you know, explaining why it's necessary to remove those. So that is the context in which we walked into. We were very sympathetic and in solidarity with that. And we knew it was going to be a very delicate conversation, but that we also had an incredible group of collaborators and people inside the university and outside the university that could help organize these kind of public conversations. And that was really, really important, because one, we just needed to find out what it was that people wanted. And two, people needed to feel that they were being heard for it to really matter. And that was key. And that kind of had to be designed. We had to really think about how we did that work. We had an online survey, which was great for alumni and for the students, so that we could, you know, just get feedback. We had over 200 responses to that. as well. So we had in person, you know, we met with alumni in Washington, D.C. I mean, you know, we tried all of these. We had ambassadors that were going out into the community to meet with different organizations and groups. And we talked to students in high school. Like, we really tried to kind of galvanize an understanding of what this might mean.
And just to situate this in a kind of timeline, this consultation was happening from 2016 up until what time?
Well, the dialogues that we had and the community meetings, and I mean, it basically went through the project even after it was done. I mean, our last community meeting was in July of 2020, actually. And so this was going on the entire time that we were working on the project, because the university had no budget, they had no program, and they had no site, which is very unusual. And, you know, as I've said, you know, in other contexts, it's a dream project or it's your worst nightmare. And it was very delicate given the topic, that we had to be very, very, very careful in making sure that the project was truthful about the history that happened at the university, about what went on, who was there. And so that people, particularly the African-Americans and Blacks in Charlottesville, felt that the university was finally acknowledging that history.
One of the reasons why I wanted to understand the time frame for these conversations is because I'm sure that an international audience who hears the name Charlottesville will probably think of, in addition to figures like Jefferson or the university, the Unite the Right rally that took place in 2017. And the profoundly disturbing imagery that came out of that, and understand that place in particular as being, extremely heated.
Well, I mean, it was. I mean, it did happen smack, you know, like 1 year into the project, basically. The Unite the Right rally happened. To our good fortune, we had had approval from the Board of Visitors June of 2017, and that... you know, that conflict happens in August. So it happens 2 months after, a little less than 2 months after we get approval for our design. And we did the design. I mean, we started in October and we came up with the design, not completed, but a sense of what it was going to be, to get the Board of Visitors to basically sign off. And the Board of Visitors is the Board of Trustees. They're appointed by the governor. So it's also, it can be a very political body in the university. So the fact that we were able to get it approved, again, just took, you know, I mean, it literally took a village to get, to get that approval. But we did, again, understand that there was a reckoning going on in that region. You know, we met with archaeologists and descendants at what's called Montpelier, which is about 40 miles north of Charlottesville. And that is that was the plantation of James Madison and his family. And they've done really extraordinary work excavating the history of that site, again, reaching out and finding out who were the descendants of the enslaved community that lived and worked at Montpelier. They were helpful in that. But also, again, Monticello has done an extraordinary amount of work with the community that is descendant from the enslaved people there. Jefferson owned up to, I think they believe, about 600 people over his lifetime, with 200 at one, you know, kind of working his various plantations at one time. And that was not easy, to get the Jefferson family and their descendants to accept that Jefferson had had a concubine, Sally Hemings, who was the half-sister of his wife, no less, and had children who were, I think, at that point, maybe 1/8 or 1/16 Black, who were enslaved. So these were little white children who were enslaved. So, I mean, it's just complicated histories of the ways in which slavery linked peoples of European descent and peoples of African descent, and the ways in which these contemporary institutions have to negotiate that. And so we were fortunate to then have, you know, all of these people, these, you know, people who are running institutions and historians and archaeologists and activists and community organizers and descendant organizations who had been doing this work to really challenge things like the Lost Cause that put, you know, these statues to Confederate figures, you know, in sites around cities in the South. I mean, I think Southern Poverty Law Center says there are over 5,000 of these monuments all over the place to Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee. And who does that? You lost a civil war. And I always argue that these aren't Confederate monuments, these are American monuments. And what they are reflecting are fundamental American values that did not disappear after the Civil War, but simply became retrenched in other ways. And so contending with that is part and parcel of what we had to do with the memorial.
I want to talk more now about the way that Black lives and Black history is rendered now in this new monument. Taking into account, I guess, the challenges you faced in collecting names and experiences of the people that the monument is memorializing. And what I'm thinking about first is this engraving that you've shown. I think it's an engraving, it may be a drawing, that you've shown in one of your lectures of the campus after its completion. It's a kind of bird's eye view of the lawn with the various pavilions arranged symmetrically around it. And at the top is the Palladian Rotunda. And in the like lower left-hand corner, you have to look very, very closely. There's a Black woman carrying a white child. And there's this kind of sense that a forensic analysis of documentation of the university is required to even start to comprehend this other side of life on the campus, which is a slide of enslaved people. And even further to that point, you come through historical ledgers and correspondence, again, to start to piece together the lives of these people. Could you tell me more about the discoveries you made and then how you translated those identities into matter, into a monument?
Kind of engaging the slave archive. The university had set up something called the President's Commission to Study Slavery at the University. And so there were actually a really great group of historians who had gone through letters, ledgers of the university, and started to record exactly how would a landscape of slavery, or as Lewis Nelson, you know, who's an architectural historian at UVA and a member of the President's Commission and really an important a part of kind of the group charged with the memorial, which is a landscape of tyranny. And they had, found in the correspondence of the wives of the professors, work logs, you know, just come up with names, oftentimes no last name, just a name, which would identify a skill. Certainly there would be a date. So through that, the historians really had put together a kind of picture of how slavery worked at the university from the beginning of 1817, when Jefferson goes to scout the land. He shows up with a group of enslaved men to start clearing the land. So from that period, 1817 to 1865 and emancipation, the end of the Civil War, there were enslaved people there. And so that work of the historians really gave us a sense of what that would mean. And what we heard from our engagements was, you know, like any monument, you want to have a figure, you want to have a name, you want dates. But that's the problem of an archive of slavery, is that it's fragmentary, and it's violent, and it's the exclusion from it is exactly what produces your condition of not being human. You know, the essential sense that you have no place in history and you have no history because you are a piece of property. And so contending with that was difficult. And yet, as you saw the physical site, you started to understand, the pavilions are two stories on the lawn side. So in that perspective, you see, you know, this incredible view with the Platonic form of the rotunda, you know, this crucible of the book and enlightenment. But it's built up almost on a mound. And so on the backsides of those pavilions, it's actually three stories. And so there's a basement level, and that's where the kitchens were. And that's where initially the enslaved people lived until, you know, they complained that Jefferson's architecture was inadequate and they had to start to build small dependencies, houses in the rear gardens spaces, workspaces behind these beautiful serpentine walls that today those gardens are sort of, you know, kind of beautiful parterred gardens, you know, run by like the garden club of UVA. But actually those were work yards where, you know, they slaughtered animals, cut wood, washed clothing, hung clothing. You know, it was a work yard hidden by, you know, the exquisite geometry and construction of that one brick thick serpentine wall, which some people would even argue that the specific height and that shape prevented the sound actually from traveling. So Jefferson understood that slavery was abhorrent. And he writes this in the Notes on the State of Virginia. He was concerned about moral degradation, of the violence that was necessary to keep someone enslaved. So he hid it. He just, you know, he used the architectural section to disappear the presence of the enslaved body. You see this in Monticello, in the dining room, where my colleague, Reinhold Martin, writes a really wonderful essay about that in our book, Race and Modern Architecture, about, you know, the ways in which the presence of the enslaved body can be disappeared through the dumbwaiter that moves the wine, you know, these apparatuses that Jefferson makes so that the enslaved aren't there listening to the conversation, right, that is making the Republic. You know, he hides at Monticello, he hides the dependencies below the house, again, so you don't see them. So you have these pristine vistas like at UVA. So there's a way in which the architecture is doing a certain kind of work. And so the ledgers, you know, help us understand like what was the day-to-day in those spaces.
I wondered if we could now talk about the form of the memorial to enslaved laborers and how, in a way, it does the work of affording a visibility or kind of reinstating or recuperating a history that up until this point was effectively invisible.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we understood, you know, from our public conversations that you know, that the memorial really needed to be a site where, you know, that people could really understand the scale and scope of slavery. And I would say I should be clear that the university didn't own that many people. It wasn't as if the university ran like a plantation at all. The university often just rented people. And that was not also, again, unusual. There was very much an economy of that plantations would rent out, especially skilled workers. You know, like if you needed somebody who was an expert carpenter and somebody on another plantation or a business in town needed it, you would rent that person for a week. Or sometimes, you know, you could rent them for a year. That's how Washington, D.C. was, in fact, built. And so to really get the sense of the 4,000 people that lived, worked, built the university, it was very important to do that. And yet the problem was that we had an archive that was incomplete. So it was an attempt to try to both work against the monument form in the West, but also deal with an archive that was fragmentary and laced with violence. And we had to name names. We were told, you know, we can't just have this abstract form. We need to see who these people were. And yet we don't know what they look like. There are very few photographs of the enslaved. And so, you know, these became challenges for how we designed the memorial. We didn't even have a site. We had to help figure out, like, is it going to be at the lawn? You know, is it going to be at a different site that had been a site of a anatomical theater? Would it be on where it is now, the Triangle of Grass? And all of those sites produce different responses and scales of response. And so the design process was a complicated one. Plus we had to share it with the public, but we also had to share it with the university. We also, fortunately, the Office of the Architect at UVA was really extraordinary. Alice Rauscher, Mary Hughes, Sarita Herman, and then the different liaisons that we worked with within the university were incredibly helpful in terms of, you know, people in the board of making sure the Board of Visitors understood what was going on, when the president needed to know. You know, so there were a lot of things that had to be juggled in the process of designing the project. But it was most important to have something that everyone felt spoke to the need to tell the truth about this community and try to construct the community. And the challenge was we didn't have the name. So what we did was for the 4,000, there are marks, what we call memory marks on the arc of the interior arc of the memorial. We had you maybe roughly 800 references, 900 references. 500 of those references are first names mostly. We know a few first name, last name, probably about 15, 20 people, first name, last name. And then for the 300s that, you know, that we have references to, which would typically be like in a ledger, hired three Negro hands at Christmas, or two slave carpenters were hired for a week. We used kinship relationships and work occupations to describe them. So when you see these memory marks, you see names, many first names, but you also see things like laundress or fiddler or stonemason or brickmason, servant, or you see mother or father or daughter or friend. And so you now see these names, not just as individuals, but as families and communities and workers. And this, we felt, really helped build a genealogical cloud for all of these people for whom we don't know. And then the marks were great because, you know, there's still archival work going on. Families are emerging saying, oh, I am related to Thrymston Hearne and I know these particular ancestors were there, so that we can now carve names onto the memorial. And that has happened since the memorial has been completed.
And they do appear like wounds in the surface of the rock. And there's some imagery up close of these cuts after it's just rained, and it appears as if the monument is weeping, and it maybe sounds, I don't know, embellished to describe it like that now, but the imagery itself is incredibly powerful and moving. So it's that kind of experience that's around the outer arc, and then there's an inner arc, which itself has a timeline. Could you talk more about the timeline?
Yeah, the cuts are, we refer to them as gashes, you know, and they're meant to kind of be, you know, like a kind of almost cutting. And they could be read both ways. Like, you know, we were told, you know, we had to show the pain and suffering, but we needed to show the humanity and the dignity, right? And scarification, you know, can also be in West African and African traditions, a way of beautification. And so we were trying to work with a kind of ambiguity in terms of how things get read, and that idea that the water, we didn't know the water would pool in that way and produce almost this kind of weeping. But it was simply a fortuitous outcome of just the ways in which the parabolic wall is actually cut. And so there's in the middle, there is this gathering space that's a ground, that's a lawn. And one of the first groups we talked to were the students who pushed for the memorial. Like, the whole thing began because students demanded the university account for this history. That group who really pushed for a more fitting memorial, there was a plaque that was put, you know, about 10 years ago or so. That wasn't enough for a new generation. They wanted a memorial. And they wanted a place to gather. They felt that it was important that the memorial could also be a space for them to gather for activism. And so we knew we wanted to have some kind of center space. And surrounding that center space is a kind of bench and timeline with a very, very, very thin water feature, right, that washes over that timeline, you know, that has a number of entries, probably about 80 entries that, you know, starts with the first arrival of Africans in 1619 to Virginia, mentions 1817, the group that comes with Jefferson, you know, and it comes from these letters. Like, we, you know, we tell, like, you know, in 1830, so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so, and so were here at the university. Like, we give the names and they were there. Or, you know, Thrymston Hearne was a really great stone cutter. And he made the rotunda stairs. So, you know, it's an accounting of the daily life of the enslaved. We account, there are a couple that describe when people ran away. You know, they were found in the Orange County jail and they were brought back. They were narratives of violence. There's one that actually describes a rape. One that describes when students beat a student. We talk about, you know, when Isabella Gibbons arrives and, you know, the fact that she taught herself to read and write. And so that timeline ends with a quote from Isabella Gibbons, because she's the only one that we have a photograph, which becomes the outside. This is the work that Eto does. And, you know, we know her first name, a last name, a date of death. We don't know when she was born. We know roughly when she arrives at the university to work, I believe, in Pavilion 6 as a cook. and that she was self-taught how to read and write, which was, of course, illegal. And she writes an article for the Freedmen's Recorder about an attempt to say, no, this is what we will remember of slavery, because she saw happening in 1867, the lost cause information, the idea that the slaves were happy, they loved us, and they still love us. And she was like, no, 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 no. What we remember is the violence. We remember the whip. We remember being chased by dogs, the collars, you know, the theft of children from their mothers. And we don't forget that we were killed. And this is what we remember of slavery, and not that we were just some docile, happy group of dancing enslaved people. And that's the quote that ends the timeline.
And it's incredibly powerful what's done with the image of Isabella. And could you talk more about how the photograph of her is translated or kind of represented in the memorial itself?
Well, one of the things that we heard in one of our meetings, and this is one, I never forget this meeting, it was the one where we were finally settled on a site. We had the form of the circle, like we had the basic form, right? And it was this beautiful, pristine white model, you know, which I mean, it's a very architectural model. And we were like, yes, you know, and, you know, we knew that this was the direction that we were going to push it. So we present it publicly in a forum at the Jefferson School to the public audience. And it was just like, that's all good and well, but this is very abstract and we don't know what this means. Mm. We need to see people. We need statuary. Mm. You know, they were thinking bronze, enslaved people, struggling. And we were like, we're not, we were so insistent of not going down that road. And so we came back and we just started to think, well, how can we embody, how can we make visible the enslaved? First, we thought of the sound of the spiritual, right? And we knew that the parabolic curve would have certain sonic qualities. And so we thought about that. And we found an image of the work of an artist, Edo Otitigbe. And we really like the way in which he worked with this sense of like scarification. He is Nigerian American, but also dealing with, he does an amazing series with him wearing a hoodie. And the way the vertical cuts, which he calls a kind of scarification work, is that he appears and he disappears. He is seen with the hood on and the hood off. And we were really fascinated by Edo's work. And we thought, wow, wouldn't it be an amazing way to do something to the exterior? And so we were really ecstatic that we were able to bring Edo on, who did a beautiful inscription of the eyes of Isabella Gibbons on the exterior, translating that technique from small MDF boards, I believe, is how he would make the work. And it's really beautiful and small, to this huge size memorial done in granite, Virginia Mist granite. And so, you know, with customized software, working with Cora Stone, who are fabricators, working with our contractors, the university architect, Howler and Yoon, you know, coming up with a way to actually translate the image of Isabella Gibbons' eyes, blow it up, and then produce this lenticular image on the outside, you know, is kind of what we ended up, so that the exterior has a kind of bush hammering surface, which is kind of like carving away, like if you were, you know, taking a chisel. And Edo was sort of inspired by a tombstone at the Daughter of Zion African American cemetery. And thinking of like, what would a labor of a stonemason be doing, carving away at the granite, making Thrymston Hearn, he's making the stair, he's a skilled scrapman. So this idea of the marking of the stone, of the labor was very important, but we also thought about scarification. There's that famous photograph of William who had been, I believe it's William, who had been beaten, you know, had been whipped, you know, and it kind of became an iconic abolitionist image. And, you know, the kind of scars of slavery. But the scar can also be a sign of beauty. And so the exterior and the way in which, you know, the arc, the exterior arc is, you know, works is it has these kind of layerings of markings. And one of them is this lenticular image of Isabella Gibbons' eyes that appears and disappears depending on, you know, the way in which the light hits it and the position of the body. So she's a very ghostly presence, as opposed to, let's say, the bronze monument of Thomas Jefferson that sits in front of the rotunda. So there's an interesting kind of dialogue between the rotunda that's 80 feet wide and our our memorial, which is also 80 feet wide. And it tries to bring in these kind of cues from the existing landscape and relationships to how you approach the site.
Mm. I mean, as a way of drawing the conversation to a close, I wondered if you could share advice to young architects and students on how to go about understanding public space today and manifesting, I guess, political histories and histories of power in a way that goes beyond the conventions we're familiar with. So you talk about, for example, initially this desire for kind of statuary and a very literal representation of the struggle of enslaved people. And then this other way that you and the team of designers and artists you work with found. I mean, I'm not really phrasing the question well, but I'm just thinking about young practitioners or students who might be listening to this. What are the kind of clues or ways of seeing the potential of a public space that you could kind of give?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it really has, you have to challenge your own education. I still think that there is something, you know, and this goes back to the origin of the profession of architecture in figures like, you know, from Palladio to Thomas Jefferson, you know, these kind of gentlemen practitioners, right? You know, that shifts a little bit once the field gets professionalized in the West in the 1850s, right? But I still think that it like a lot of creative fields, music, or around creative genius, right? You know, that you are this lone visionary, you know, and architectural education is really predicated on that. But actually, if you really want to forge change and make difference, you got to organize and you got to work collaboratively. And in the truth of the way in which architecture is actually practiced is it's collaborative. You never, ever, as an architect, work alone. And I think kind of recognizing the value of collaboration, and that's how you enact change. And it's not instant. It takes time. You know, there were many students who pressured the university, and they didn't do it individually. They did it collectively. There were sit-ins, and they made it visible. They did a competition to do that. That's why it's called the Memorial to Enslaved Laborers. That's what the students called it. And so we honor their activism by continuing with that name. And I think that is really central. And I think that, you know, my sense is my students get that. Like at Columbia, you know, we now have organizations, you know, of women students, Latin students, African-American, Black students, queer students, like, you know, they see themselves organizing collectively. And maybe it's because of these social media and all that, you know, or all of the organizing around labor in offices. You know, again, the things like the architecture lobby, like it's not about being the singular visionary any longer. I think the collective and the collaborative are really valuable if you want things to change. And that is part and part of the design process always.
I just have one more really burning question, and then I promise you I will stop bothering you.
I'm a Gemini.
Me too.
All right, you rock.
Just thinking about like the role of classicism in architecture today, and the ways in which it's been, I guess, co-opted by the right. And we think about, for example, Trump's mandate near the end of his term in instructing all new federal buildings in the Capitol to be designed in a classical style. And we associate, for obvious reasons, classicism with conservatism. And then for reasons that you've discussed previously, with this construction of whiteness. At the same time, I mean, I know architects who are incredibly fond of classicism and understanding classicism as a kind of a relevant style of design today. How ought students grapple with the problem, if we could frame it as such, of classicism in pedagogy and in design today?
Yeah. I mean, I love using Michel Rouf-Triot's to understand how the West constructs its past in his book, Silencing the Past, right? And he says, you know, there is what happened and there is what is said to have happened, and that history is produced. You know, there's the event, but then you have to collect the evidence into the archive. It has to be organized. You know, then the historian has to access it, produce the history that is then read, right? History is produced. And in that process are emerging silences, right? So there was the classical world that was very complicated in terms of, you know, there's the Greek world and its relationship to all of its areas, the ways in which that then ends up in, let's say, the Roman world. Then there is the way in which Europe claims a kind of lineage, right, in a search for origins to that. And the ways in which classicism gets adapted into the humanist project. You know, first pagan, of course, in relationship to Christianity. But, you know, there's classical philosophy and its impact on the thinking of politics, right? So the classical project is a complicated one, depending on where and when it happens. So, for example, we had a PhD student recently who did a project actually on Inigo Jones, looking at the ways in which what becomes Great Britain utilizes its own legacy of Roman antiquity, right, to construct itself as being civilized, precisely because the Anglo-Saxons, they were understood as to be barbaric, right? These are in the medieval world, and yet buried there is this classical history of Rome. And so the recuperation of that to say that, no, we have this legacy and this great history becomes incredibly important, because then at that moment, as Britain is imagining itself conquering Scotland and then literally the plantation of Ulster moving into Northern Ireland, you know, this is what gives them a sense of, oh, we are a civilizing force that is taking on this more barbaric, pagan, particularly Catholic, you know, and the Irish get completely racialized, right? Their difference, human differences, they're literally racialized, you know, that goes then in the Irish for years, you know, to the point where, you know, they're associated with the Iberians and they're associated literally with the Negro. And so that project of classicism in the West does a kind of way of both constructing lineage, you know, which is very important in a Newtonian world of origins, but also gives legitimacy around the kind of Gothic barbarian that Europe, the Dark Ages, you know, was positioned as. And so I think there's a way in which classicism helps kind of recuperate and frame a kind of enlightened Europe. And it gets claimed again and claimed again and claimed again. It's never a stable category. Gothic comes back because it's somehow actually more truthful to the origins, right, of Germany and Great Britain and Northern Europe, right, in the 19th century. So these categories are always fluctuating around in the sense of, like, what does that say about an identity of difference, of human difference, that is often racialized.
Mabel, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
So that was the extended version of my conversation with Professor Mabel O. Wilson for the new podcast called Power and Public Space. Check out the full series on iTunes or wherever you're listening to this now. And I'll be back with new episodes of Scaffold in a couple weeks.
When we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.